Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Victoria Pendleton, one of the most successful British athletes of all time. After her cycling medals at the Beijing and London Olympics, she became a household name and was awarded an MBE. Since then, she has been a jockey, climbed Everest, and been a voice in breaking taboos around mental health. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. Anyway, here we go. Hope you enjoy it. Victoria Pendleton, the legend, here you are. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'll start with the obvious question, which I've started with through all of these podcasts of this series, because it's reasonably prevalent, is how has lockdown been for you?
Well, lockdown actually hasn't been too bad for me, mainly because my life is very much like lockdown most of the time. I've been furloughed since 2012, so it feels quite familiar. And I guess for me, I spend a lot of time outdoors. I spend a lot of time doing sports. So it's just given me a more opportunity to do the things I like, really. Yeah, it's been, I've actually really enjoyed it. I think the biggest thing about lockdown is being able to prioritize your fitness training.
Yeah.
And for me, that is a real it's a familiarity about my health. Keeping that routine in, doing your training every day, being able to do that in your own time for as long as you like is a blessing, and something I definitely have enjoyed. And I know I need to prioritize my fitness training, because sometimes it gets lost in the midst of the chaos of what you do in your life and going here and doing that and flying off here and not really thinking, well, I want to make that time for me. It's important. It's important for my body. It's important for my mind. It's definitely reminded me to prioritize fitness.
Yeah, it's been, to be honest, I've managed to get in some decent routines. It's actually starting to taper off now, because you know, things are slowly going back to normal. People are getting busier, and I'm like, hang on a minute, I want the whole day to train.
Carry on with lockdown, please.
Yeah, no, I know it's been tough for a lot of people, but I'm, you know, and I'm making light of the situation. Yeah. But
same.
It has been a good thing for getting like your routine fizz in physical exercise. But are you still quick on a bike?
Do you know what? I surprised myself, actually.
not that you're blowing your own trumpet.
I looked at my average K now and I was like, that's not bad, actually. I don't get involved with all the Strava and all that, because I know that that would be scratching away at my competitive side. So I was like,
yeah. You don't want to open up that can of worms.
No. But because I've been doing so much running, my cardio has probably not been this good for a long time. I don't have the power and the explosive strength that I used to have, because I don't put the weight training, the power training in as much. But in terms of my CV, my VO2 max is really good at the moment. And it feels nice, especially approaching my 40th birthday, to be in a place that, you know.
When's that?
September.
What have you got planned?
Well, I was going to go and stay in a little castle in Scotland in the Cairngorms and be hiking.
Well, it might still happen.
Fingers crossed.
You've got to get your bookings in early, I reckon.
It's all booked. I booked all right. About a year ago, but I'm hoping that it will still go ahead.
Yeah, I reckon you'll be all right. Yeah, keep a positive mindset and all that lark. Anyway, let's get back to you and the story of Victoria Pendleton. What was your childhood like, actually? Let's go right back.
So I was a very quiet child and incredibly shy. and awkward. And I really found that sport was the only thing that I felt that I could really express myself doing. Like, it was the one thing that came naturally to me and that I was quite good at. So I joined every kind of sports team. I tried everything, and I was always encouraged to do lots of sport. I've got a twin brother, so we always used to go and like, hey, should we go to the tennis courts today? Should we do this today? Like, we always found stuff to do, and it was nice to have someone to always participate in sport with. My dad is a very keen cyclist, so we spent a lot of time on the bikes training. I realise now that the kind of mileage I was putting in as a child, though, was unusually high, but at the time it just seemed like the norm. So he kind of prepared me physically. And probably why I was good at sport is because I was fit from a very young age compared to my peers. And for that, I'm very grateful. So I had quite a very outdoorsy.
What was your first bike?
It was a second-hand bike, hand-me-down, for my sister, probably. And I don't remember. Well, I had a trike first. I had three wheels first when I was a toddler. And I still had a dummy. I had three wheels. And then I got two wheels. And I do remember the pressure of my dad getting me to ride without stabilizers, because my brother had done it a few weeks prior. And he was like, right, there's no excuse. Oh. You've got to do it now. And I was like, okay, Dad, I can do it. And I remember him pushing us up the road, you know, by pushing our backs and then letting go, and it being kind of like, oh. But I had that competitive drive. I was like, well, Alex can do it. I can do it. So we both got on these oversized bikes, saddles right down on the top tube. I remember my first road bike first, because Dad let us choose the colours to have it resprayed, because they were both secondhand road frames, and I went with a white and blue fade, very 80s.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what make was it? I don't know why I'm interested.
I don't even know what it was, to be perfect.
Because there's so many bikes out there now, isn't there?
It was just resprayed, so I would never have known anyway. It was just blue and white. It was a unique, one of a kind, bespoke blue and white bike.
Remember when I was a kid, it was like, I think there was just rally.
The rally chopper.
Yeah, rally.
That's too fancy for me.
Now there seems to be just too many bikes. There's too many mate brands, and I get confused. They're mega expensive as well.
I actually, somebody at that embarrassing moment was like, how much does a good bike cost these days? And I was like, I don't know. And then I was thinking, how many bikes have I actually paid for in my life? And I was like,
None.
That's embarrassing. Yeah. It's like when someone says, how much is a pint of milk? And you're like, no, I have no idea.
But so obviously that's how you started off. What was life like as a teenager? Were you, by that stage, were you like fully involved in the sport?
Well, I was racing from the age of 9. Just in small schoolgirls and schoolboys events, they're called. Like, they'd put a couple of races on at a track event for youngsters. And I was training at the weekend, doing the sports I wanted to do throughout the week. I was cycling to school quite a lot, and it was about a 7-mile ride. It wasn't anything fancy, or like a challenging ride. And I was... it was a hobby, but it was a serious hobby. You know, I spent my free time preparing for it. And after school, I might go for a bike ride with my dad. Not that much. It wasn't serious, because I think my dad appreciated that as a kid, you need to find joy in what you're doing. You can't push kids to do things they don't want to do. So he didn't get serious really with my training until I was probably about 15. And he suddenly thought he could see some potential in me. And I was talent spotted the following year by the national team. So after that point, it got serious, like having a real training program rather than just being sporty 7 days a week.
You were racing for the school, yeah?
Racing for my local cycling club.
Oh, cycling club. And then obviously the national teams have got their scouts that go out and watch. So they obviously watched competitive, like inter-club stuff.
Yeah, so they didn't necessarily watch me, but all the results used to be printed in the back of the Cycling Weekly magazine. So even the smallest event, and you have to get a magnifying glass out to read the print. But my name kept cropping up, and they were like, need to speak, find out who this girl is and what she's up to. And they knew who my dad was, because he'd been quite on the domestic scene, was quite well known in the lower cap kind of road races, hill climbs and those kind of things. And he invited me up to Manchester. And I remember the day that Marshall Thomas, who was the assistant coach, rang my house and I was like, Dad, there's a man on the phone, says he wants me to go to Manchester. And my dad was like, and I was like, because it was totally unexpected, out of the blue. I never thought that it would take me that far.
Well, so was that England or GB? I don't know. How does it, can you explain to us how that works, this sort of national setup? Mm.
So there is actually only like a British Cycling, which is Team GB, is selected from. But during Commonwealth cycles, there's a Team England and Scotland and Wales separately that pan off. So they might have a development program for English athletes in a couple of years up to the Commonwealth Games, but it's not a permanent program as it, like home nation kind of thing. It's only Team GB. So I was asked to join the England potential program because we had the Manchester Commonwealth Games.
Yeah.
Coming up.
When was that then?
That was, when was that? When was that? That's how good my brain is. Can't even remember.
It's an irrelevant question. I'm just obsessed with dates and times.
So they kind of set up an England potential program, and that's the first official program I went to. They talent spotted me, but I didn't accept the proposal until I finished university.
Right.
I really felt there was no lottery funding for athletes at the time in 96. You were looking at a career where you had a part-time job and you trained part-time and you represented Great Britain. And we weren't a great sporting nation for that reason, because we didn't ever have the funding behind athletes to be full-time and compete with nations who have government-funded programs of athletes and support networks. So I was like, I'm going to go to uni, I'm going to do sports science, I'm going to train while I'm there and keep fit, because it allows you to use much better facilities than I had in my hometown of Stotfold, Bedfordshire. And and then sort of go into it once I've got something to fall back on. And I thought I'll be able to get a better part-time job being a graduate than I would otherwise. And also I'll be able to elevate my standard to make the Great Britain team selection times. When
where did you go to where did you go to uni?
Northumbria, Newcastle.
All right, and you still managed to, even though you're there doing that, obviously that allowed you to still cycle, didn't it?
So basically they offered a small bursary for minority sports athletes, which was really rare, so that's the reason I chose that university. And it allowed me to travel to Manchester to do 5 days in the month with the team full time, and then bring my training back and use the facilities to train in my own time. And my lecturer, my tutor at uni, was a very keen long distance running coach, and he said to me, there's enough time at university to train to be an elite athlete, to get a degree, and there is the opportunity to socialise. He goes, there's three things you can do with your time, but realistically, you can only do two, and make that choice now. And I did. Mm. So I didn't really have a social life at uni, but I could train as much as I wanted to. They had a fantastic gym. I had free weights coaching, and I studied really hard. So I chose that because I wanted to make it. I wanted to make it onto the team.
Yeah. Well, that's dedication to what you wanted to do. You know, you could have been really good at drinking, but instead you...
No, I used to occasionally go out to a club, which I loved, but it was a sacrifice I was willing to make because your career's so short and I really wanted to make it.
Yeah, well, you made the right decision, I'd say. Can you remember, I don't know whether this is fast-forwarding or not, but... can you remember the first major cycling race you won, and what was it?
So, in terms of a GB athlete, or
I don't know. No, in your mind, what was the first standout race for you?
Okay, I think probably for me, I was 16, and I won the national grass track 800 meters title, which is really insignificant.
What is it? Say that again. The grass national
grass track racing.
As in on grass.
So it's a track bike with slightly knobbly, like almost cross tires, cyclocross tires. And it's a 400 meter, usually on a like a really on turf, so maybe a round of cricket ground.
Pitch, yeah.
So they choose some a nice turf, and basically they peg out the inside. So there's wooden pegs, don't hit those. And then you just race like track racing. So obviously you have to, it's hard work because you're riding on grass on a fixed wheel bike.
Yeah.
And if you go too fast, you slide out.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting contrast between power and sort of like, oh, just tempering it. But it was really good bike handling skills as well to move on to the velodrome. You know, I had ridden on really bumpy, nasty grass tracks, but also being small and light had an advantage because I'm racing against fully grown men, maybe 85 kgs sinking in the mud. And I'm kind of skimming over the top of the dirt.
No way.
And they're like, oh, and I was picking up wins. So that was, it played to my advantage for the only time in my life, being a little bit more lightweight than my competitors, paid off. So it was insignificant, but I won a set of Reynolds steel tubes to have a bike built, a track bike built to my exact size. And that, for me, I was like, wow, they're giving me like a box of tubes awesome. To get a bike built for me. And I used that bike for many years, and that was kind of, for me, like the first one. I was like, wow. It was so tiny, but I felt really proud of it.
That's awesome. That's a great story. So let's fast forward now to when you're now in the GB side. I'm making this up in my head.
Yeah.
You're in the GB side. And the bit that I'm mega interested in, really, is the training regime. You know, when you're the build up to, say, like, Commonwealth Games or Olympics, you know, I always picture it being scientists everywhere. You're, you know, you're probably 24/7 attached to some pipe stuck in your mouth, so you can be, like, you know, they can work out how well your lungs are working, and you're just constantly getting up early. Is that what it's like?
Not really.
Sorry.
We spend a lot of time training in a lab environment. Well, these days people spend a lot. Throughout my career, it changed dramatically, and the funding that cycling had due to its success allowed us to have a very substantial gym with various different cycle ergometers built for specific training. We had one particular bike, and it was purely for strength training. It had the equivalent, to anybody who knows cycling, to 128-inch gear. So something that you couldn't move from a standstill on. It would be like...
Okay, yeah.
For example, and all the torque was measured in the cranks, and you really just had to do like strength training. You maybe only do about like 5 revolutions and you'd be gassed. You'd be like... And then we had like bikes with tiny little cranks on where you had to sort of really spin as fast as possible to get the leg speed. And they had... it was like 300 RPM.
Yeah.
You'd be like, your legs would be buzzing. And they were all very much, you know, the information was collected, the power, the strain gauges and the cranks, it was all very scientific. So everything was plotted. So we had very specific numbers of every effort we did on the track and off the track. The numbers were collated, you were delivered that information, you knew where you were exactly. But it was, you know, 6 days a week. Twice a day, at least twice a day. Some days, 3 sessions a day. And if you weren't there, you're in the physio getting fixed up. and that was it, or eating. It seemed to be all we did, like eating, training, sleeping. That's it, which I love.
And was that all still up in Manchester?
In
Is
Manchester,
that like the home of British cycling?
Yeah. Home of British cycling. Yeah, no, if you're on the national team, you have to move to Manchester to train with the team, which was a great thing, because for me, I moved into a team with Jason Queeley, Chris Hoy, Craig McLean, Jamie Starr, multiple world and Olympic champions. I'm surrounded by guys who have been there and done it. And I always felt very grateful because I knew the standard that I needed to try and attain in order to be successful, because they did it every day. I couldn't ever be as fast. I can hold on to that back wheel as much as I can, like follow them as hard as I could. But I couldn't have had better role models and support system around me. And they actually were really helpful in terms of writing training programs, sometimes tweaking them, giving advice and stuff like that. They were a good bunch of guys to be around and the most successful in the world, which is a perfect environment to be in. Like, I feel very lucky. Great guys as well, like really great guys.
I'd suggest that you're pretty much at the top of your game as well.
You
dominated international cycling for a number of years. So you've got, what is it, a record 6 individual sprint titles between 2005, 2012. I mean, how did you stay motivated for that long? Because it is, you know, training 6 days a week, you know, with a regime where you're being told pretty much what to eat, when to eat, and when to get up and when to do this.
Yeah.
It can be draining, you know. Yeah. So what was your motivation to continually do that?
I guess the biggest thing for me is, one, I was being paid to do it as a job.
Okay, yeah. That's...
It's important. Okay. It's important. It's very different when it's your job and you're representing your country and that is your job. It's very different from doing it as a hobby and feeling a bit like, well, I don't really feel like giving it my all today. I felt very honoured to have that as, you know, and I had to remind myself, like, I'm pulling on, every day I'm pulling on red, white and blue jersey for training. We had to go in a uniform and, you know, you put that flag on, you think, yeah, today I'm going to give it my best, because you know your career is so short-lived. One injury, you're done. And for me, I was always like, I'm going to try and make the most of it, because I don't want to get to a point, I think, could I have done more? Could I have done more? Could I have pushed myself a little bit further? Because I can honestly say, sat here right now, I couldn't have done any more than I did in terms of give myself wholeheartedly to my training. I couldn't have done any more. And I think I got the most I could out of it. And that, for me, means it can be put to bed in some ways, rather than, oh, what if? What if is the most terrifying thing. What if? And I wouldn't want to be plagued by that for the rest of my days in retirement. They're a long time retired as an athlete. You've got to maximise when you can, and then all the other stuff in life can wait. It can really wait. And I didn't find that hard to do at all, really.
That's awesome. That's, I mean, yeah. If you can sit there after it all and say, there's nothing else I could have given, I reckon that's a testament to your character, VP, I would suggest. But I'll tell you what I'm also interested in is, there's a reason I'm asking this question, is what role did competition with your rivals have? So I've just finished watching, like, The Last Dance.
Yes!
You watched it?
Yes.
It's good. I say just finished. I finished it a few weeks ago, but I was, like, glued to that. And, I've played... I'm going to be embarrassed myself now. I've played sport throughout my time, not at any decent level, but at level where there's competition.
Yeah.
And I used to love that.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, you know, in cycling for you, what, you know, was it an important part, that rivalry? And you, there was characters that you knew that you would go up against. What was that like?
Well, there was definitely some very well-publicised rivalries between myself and Anna Mears of Australia, and some of the press was a little bit, let's say, creative in how it was portrayed.
The press, creative, no way.
And I actually sat in a press conference once, and an Australian guy from I don't know what publication was like, "Is Anna Mears a cow?" And I was like, and I laughed because I was like, that is the most ridiculous question I've ever been asked, but obviously trying to get me to dish the dirt on my rivals, show my anger. But I definitely didn't form any relationships with the people I was racing against, because I wanted to beat them, all of them, everyone.
You didn't want the human element to come into it.
No, definitely never. So I probably came across as quite cold. Generally, I didn't really get involved with getting to know people. I didn't really care. I didn't want to know their stories. I didn't want to feel anything for them. I just wanted to beat them. I just wanted to literally just tick a box and go, beaten you. And I knew when I went into, for example, the Olympic Games, there was nobody on the competition list that I hadn't beaten. So I was like, yeah, that's how I want it to be. But watching that documentary, so many elements of it really struck a chord with me, because there was definitely, for me, if someone did something like knock me off my line, give me an elbow coming around the corner, all these things, because I play very, very fair, very straight. Like, I don't get involved with things. I'm not going to, if no one's looking, give someone, I'm not going to do that. It's not me. I've always been somebody who follows the rules. it would rile me on the inside, and I'd be like, they have done it. And yeah. And sometimes I'd just sit there looking at someone, looking through them, and be like, you know, okay.
You're allowed. It's all good.
But I just feel like, you know, like I was like, there is no way you were going to beat me. And I just feel like that kind of rage almost, I just kept like contained. I was like, you've really done it now. Like, I'm sorry. And I do feel like that negative motivation to push yourself is very powerful. Not necessarily right. A lot of people think negative motivation in sport is wrong, that like you should be positively motivated. But for me, most of it was like, I'm going to prove those fuckers wrong. They said, yeah. I'm too small, I can't do it, I'm too feminine, I'm too light, blah, 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 you're too this, you're too emotional, you're too feminine, you're not much like a man. All this, my whole life, I've been bombarded by people making visual judgments on me. Even the national coach, when I joined Team GB, just the new coach had just moved there, he told me in his French-Canadian accent, Miss Victoria, I'm going to find you very annoying. And I was like, you have no natural jump and you're too puny to be a sprinter. I suggest you look to other elements of cycling. And I was like, right. And I took, but initially I was really like gobsmacked and hurt. And I was like, and I took that away and I was like, there's two things I can do with that comment. I can take it to heart and go and cry in a corner, or I can prove him wrong. And then I was like, I'm just going to quietly keep my head down, work hard, and prove him wrong. And I did. You know, he left the team, went to work with Australia, and I thrashed the pants off all of his athletes. And he came to shake my hand in New Yorker. I'd just become world champion in three different disciplines, which had never been done before. I won the team sprint, and Kieran. And he came over and he shook my hand and he said, no, I was wrong about you. And I was like, you know, I really appreciate that he did, you know, he did that. He had the ability to do that.
Yeah.
But as I shook his hand, I was like, you have no idea what you gave me. Like, you did me a favor. You filled me with so much determination to prove you wrong that I was willing to go anywhere to make it happen.
Good. I'm glad you got to do that.
Yeah.
I've been itching to get onto this subject. Oh. So I was like, get there. So it's going to be about the Olympics, yeah, and the wins. And I'll tell you what, I want to start with Beijing first. And the reason for that is because it's 2008, that summer, I was in Afghanistan for a long time. And our as a group of guys, our escape was that Olympics. So I remember you winning. We like all the stuff that happened in that Olympics. It was a massive distraction and a mega welcome one. So I want to start with that.
Well, you know what? It absolutely makes everything I've ever done worthwhile to hear someone like you say that, because sport is entertainment at the end of the day. And the fact that it has a reach to do something that provides positivity or distraction or something to someone else makes any kind of pain that you suffer, any injury, any hardship, any sacrifice, you know, insignificant in the scale of it. So thank you, Foxy. And you know what, coming from you also, and I know I've said this to you in the past and it's embarrassing, coming from someone like you, who I've got a lot of respect for, I really appreciate it, because I was just doing my job.
Well, you did your job well, and what I will say about this with sports and the Olympics, and it's a shame about what's happened this year, but you know, it will bounce back, obviously. But it does, you know, your efforts and the, you know, all the athletes, the efforts that you will put in and the time and commitment, it doesn't, you know, hopefully it doesn't go unnoticed for the masses, but it does bring countries together. You know, it brings communities together. It gives them a focus. It just helps them distract themselves away from all the rubbish noise that goes on. So that's a good thing. And yeah, I'm paying back the compliment. But go on, what was it like? What was that win like?
Well, it was weird because I arrived and we were checking out the pressure systems and the temperature and the weather over those days, because it can massively affect your speed and, you know, what the world record that I was hoping to break. I didn't, because the weather was wrong. And you have to have exactly the right temperature, and it was high pressure, which is terrible. It makes it harder. You can't go as fast.
Yeah.
There was this horrible thing going on. I was like, I'm not going to break the world record. And I remember training, and it was the first time that I tried to push the gym up to, like, gym training up to 11 days before competition. So not backing off heavy weights until the last minute. And I was a bit like, well, this is going to be quite bad. But, you know, like, I was worried, I was concerned that whether it's going to work for me. Mm. And I started to, about 3 or 4 days before competition, I was doing some efforts and I couldn't feel my legs. I was like, why can't I feel them? And then I was like, and the coaches were like, how was that for you? And I was like, ah, just can't feel anything, feel numb. And they were like, and then they showed me the stopwatch and I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, for real? And I couldn't believe it. I was going faster than I'd ever gone before and I couldn't feel it. It was like there was no pain. I couldn't hurt myself. And I was like, this is that moment that athletes speak about when their body just works at the best, yeah, highest level for that split second, that moment. And it came together and I was just like, oh my gosh, like, this feels like a dream, actually like a dream. I couldn't do anything wrong. I was like, I'm going to go now and I could overtake. And I was like, I mean, it's almost like it's too easy. And that made me feel really nervous because I was like, you're used to feeling the fatigue in your legs. So when you do something, you're like, oh yeah, God, that was hard, but I reckon, okay. But I had no sensation. And then on the last, on the day of the sprint, everything had just gone so well. I was making decisions. I was being assertive. I was building in confidence. And I really felt that I'd come into my own for the first time ever. And I was racing Annemiek in the final. I'd won the first one. I had a second sprint. And I thought, I'm not going to just win here. I'm going to annihilate her. I'm just going to go for a time and see what I can do for the last 200 because I already know I think I've got this. I sat down in the semifinals, looked at my opponent and thought, she's bricking it. It's done. And I couldn't, I was like on the inside going, oh, I've never, it's brilliant, but quite, you know, I'm never unnerving in some ways. I feel so dominant, which is something that I don't usually feel.
Yeah.
It just, I don't think in my career I ever felt as good as I did in that moment. And they reckon that the average gold medal is won at 27 and a half years of age, which is pretty much how old I was randomly during
bizarre.
In 2008. I think it's a combination of experience and body, your body being developed to a point where it's strong, undamaged, and your brain is in gear. You've got all the things.
Yeah. And that obviously proved, and the point was proven.
Yeah.
With yourself.
Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like in Beijing?
Blacklined.
Really?
They had to pull some of the support staff, the Beijing support staff, so the volunteers into the stadiums to fill them and encourage them to clap. They were having some cheering practice one day of warm up, which we thought was hysterical. Somebody was basically teaching the crowd how to make more noise. Just bizarre.
Because they put on quite a big show, didn't they? Mm. It looked, from where I was and like watching it on the TV, it looked like a big extravagant show. I mean, you know, what was it like when you were walking out onto the, you know, for the parade?
We had to watch the opening ceremony from our rooms on television. Because the coaching staff and the managers never let us do an opening ceremony because there's too much time standing up. Don't stand if you can sit and don't sit if you can lie. So we weren't allowed. We were allowed to go to the closing ceremony, which is fantastic, and everything's done and you can just relax anyway. But you potentially stood on your feet, penned and herded into the stadium, not get home till midnight, which is past our bedtime. And, you know, you're looking at 7-8 hours on your feet, which is not preparation for you know, a leg-based sports athlete. So we were never allowed to go.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
All right, that's okay. Disappointing.
I watched the London opening ceremony from my bed in my pajamas next to my teammate Jess. We both sat there with some snacks, and watched it in our pajamas.
That's odd. That is. So is it only the cycling lot that don't do it?
I think some more people do it these days.
Yeah.
If they can get away with it, because I think if you're in the first week of the Olympics,
yeah,
definitely it would be a bad idea. But some sports as well that aren't so leg dominant don't find it a problem. You know, if you're a swimmer, you know, it's equal balanced upper lower body, probably more upper body. So maybe they don't feel the same. But yeah, I mean, they think that we're no fun, but we're also winning medals. So we weren't going to change what we do.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I understand.
That's
okay, let's fast forward 4 years from Beijing to obviously the London Olympics, which was mental, as in an awesome way. It was awesome. How did you find it, and was there an extra pressure because of it being, you know, it's the home Olympics, isn't it? Which were awesome, weren't they?
I mean,
as far as a spectator, it was awesome just to watch London put that together. But yeah, go on.
It was the most wonderful event in every possible way. I think a lot of people felt that nothing would ever compare in their careers to being able to compete at a home Olympics, because you don't have no idea when you start your sport whether you'll ever have the opportunity. But going in as reigning world and Olympic champion into that four-year cycle, wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It was so much pressure from the moment I kind of came out of the last minute. Well, the next Olympics are in London. How do you think you're going to do? I was like, I'm going to do my best. But you don't know you can't force the results to happen. You can only keep training and pushing yourself. You don't know whether someone might come up who's going to be better than you. I can't control that. I can only control what happens to me. But the sponsorship, the media attention, everything was just, I mean, you couldn't look anywhere without seeing the 2012 advertising. You were like, it's there, it's everywhere. There's no escape. Every single day for that 4 years, you were like, right, London Olympics, I want to make the team. I mean, because I nearly didn't make the team. There was some controversy over whether they thought that I was past it. And I was like, well, I'd really like to give it a go, guys, as I am the reigning champion. It was tough. I had to battle to get on the team. I didn't want to miss out. It was a relief when it was over. I'm not going to lie. I enjoyed it. I appreciate it. The crowd, the noise of the crowd was unbelievable. The capacity of that velodrome in London is quite big compared to most velodromes. Sometimes you get 3,000 or so because of the dimensions of a track and how you don't block the view. There's only so big you can build stadiums.
Yeah, yeah.
But because it's an amphitheatre, the noise is deafening. Like, it shakes your ribcage when the crowd cheers. It made your sort of hairs on your arms stand on end. It was crazy. And I think, I mean, obviously the highlight of my entire career. It is filled with a lot of obviously pressure and expectation, which you will never forget that feeling. I remember lying on the floor about 20 minutes before the Kieran final with my earphones on and looking at the ceiling. And I can remember exactly what that looks like, lying on the mat, looking at the ceiling, just trying to relax. And my heart feels like it's going to explode out of my chest. And I was like, you look over the one shoulder for a split second and you basically fuck it up. It's your fault and no one else's. And I was like, because you know, you're racing with eight other people and they can do anything and you have to read the situation correctly. And you're like, I actually would rather be swallowed up by the earth right now than exist in the moment. And then you're like, no, I want to be here. I've trained really hard to be here. I deserve to be here. I do want to be here. I want to be here. I want to be here. And everything in your body is telling you, oh my God, fight or flight, fight or flight. And that's tough. That in many ways, the super champion, the person who repeats success over and over and over again, has that ability just to sort of quiet down everything that's going on inside their head and body at that moment. Because if you listen to it or allowed it to take over, you'd be a complete wreck. Just trying to keep the blinkers on when those moments are like, that sensation in your body is overwhelming.
But what's I tell you what, I've always been interested in, what's it like in the village, you know, amongst all the athletes? Is there like is there a buzz and like excitement, or is there so much pressure on everyone there that you're a bit like, ugh.
Everyone thinks it's like partying and there's these big, you know, raging parties going on and everyone's having sex, and it's like, well, it's like, no. It basically, imagine getting like 10,000 really nervous people in one enclosed space.
Yeah.
There's definitely a sense of anxiety. You can see people who have finished and they try and keep themselves separate, and some are having little parties. But on the whole, most people are walking around the dinner hall with a tray, looking like they want to like pass out or die or just escape. Like nerves. And the food courts, you basically just eat. You basically just wander around with a tray, get food. Spend as much time as you can eating, because there's nothing else in the day to distract you from the fact that you're really nervous.
Mm. Do you, when you're there in the Olympics, do you train as well, or is it just compete and then eat, sleep?
No, you train as well. So you definitely would go on the boards probably every day, at least every day, even if you just do a short 20-minute session or just keep the
how hard are you pushing yourself though, or is it just like a sort of maintaining type of level?
Some days you might do just a recovery session, so you just spin your legs for 20-30 minutes, just easy, just to sort of flush them out, get them moving, keep them supple, and then you might alternate that with days where you really go and put like maybe only three efforts in, maybe three 10 second efforts. So you do a warm-up, you know, you spend 20 minutes warming up on the rollers progressively, and then you just basically just touch your high-end speed, but without doing too much damage. But you have to keep going there to keep the body and the muscles activating, because a lot of it in sprinting is about that reactive speed, which is is kinetics in your muscles, like calcium kinetics, and you want to remind your body that to be explosive. So you just kind of go in and you do a little bit. But it's good that you have a little bit of training in your day as well, because it's part of your day that's also filled with something. Because you're not sleeping, because you're not tired, and you're nervous because you're at the Olympics. And it's, you know, it's you have a lot of time on your hands, and then, you know, you're sat down because you're not supposed to be stood up walking, trying to waste time twiddling your thumbs. It's not the easiest environment to exist in for 2 weeks. No.
Yeah, it's a sort of, I wouldn't say it's disappointing to hear that, because obviously everyone at home is like, oh, they're in the Olympic Village, it must be a right laugh, because they're
cool.
It is what it is. You know, we've got to be a realist about this. You've got like a load of reasonably young people with the weight of the world, the weight of their countries on their shoulders. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But in some ways, you know, like, for example, you can be sat in the dinner hall and you see such a range of human body types that we play guess the sport, because you're wearing a big tag where it's got your sport written small enough. So if you walk past somebody close enough, you can just take a sly glance to see what they do. And you start sort of like, right, what do you reckon? I'd be like, oof, I reckon javelin for that one. Or like, you just like, and then you try and you're like, some sports are really hard to work out what people do. Some are totally obvious, but you can see.
What would make you say a javelin? What would make you say a javelin?
Like, probably quite muscular upper body. Probably because they're track and field, they'll have a bit of swagger about them. You know, they won't be like.
Is that a thing?
Oh, track and field. They were tracking, because that's kind of cool, isn't it? It's a cool sport to be in. And then you have the team sports and the gymnasts that like march in, all these tiny people marching in with their perfect hair. And it just kind of, it's a really bizarre group of human bodies in one space. It's quite entertaining to see, but also just all the different nationalities that you meet. And the food, can I just say, Foxy, when I say there's a food hall the size of football pitch, it's got every food you could possibly imagine from around the world. So you can go and get a Yorkshire pudding and have it with some sushi and then have a North African curry on the side there. And then maybe some kind of, you know, something you've never tasted before. So you can like eat all these incredible things 24 hours of the day.
So is it good quality?
Yeah. I mean, they have to provide food as well to suit every single nation of the world's taste, because you've got to eat kind of, you know, pre-competition, you very much stick to things that you're familiar with. Obviously, you wouldn't go crazy. But when you're finished, you can try all this incredible food you've never seen before, never laid eyes on. And also watching people's eating habits, like what they go for, how much they eat. You see these, the marathon runners were like, and you're like, ooh, that's that. Really skinny people with nothing. And then like big weightlifters with like mountains of food. It's brilliant.
Yeah, whenever we were away, we used to always try, and obviously we're Brits, so unfortunately the British canteen when you're away in the military is I'm sorry to say this if anyone's a chef for those facilities, but it is diabolical. We used to always try and sneak into the American DFAC. It was called DFAC. They had like awesome scram food. So yeah, I dream of places like an Olympic Village food court. There we go. But what of all the medals you won, Olympic medals, which was the sweetest? What's the best one? The one that, you know what I mean?
I guess in London, the gold medal in London was, because there was so much expectation on it, it was hard to get. I feel like Beijing was almost a gift to me. Like I trained hard and it came to me, but I had to fight so hard for that. In terms of team politics, very much last dance in many ways, out with the old, in with the new.
Yeah.
I had to fight so hard in so many ways to that moment. And so for me, that was the biggest achievement and therefore the sweetest.
Emotional.
Very emotional. And it was the end as well. You know, I was calling it quits. I had no choice, but that was unfortunately the way it is in sport. And leaving it all behind in that one moment when it was finished, when it was over, I was overwhelmed with emotion. It's too much.
What was the atmosphere like when, like literally seconds before you started, during it? I bet you can't remember the race that much, as in what was going on around you.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, you're aware of the noise to some degree when your name is announced, because you roll up to the line and then they'll go so-and-so from here and here. And obviously, it's like, yay, yay, yay. And you're like, wow. And then it's it was disproportionate to be a GB athlete there. You got like an extra boost, which I'm grateful for, very grateful for. But then once the whistle's blown, nothing. It could be nobody in that velodrome, not one person. It wouldn't make a difference because you're in your zone doing your job. It doesn't matter. And then, obviously, when you cross the line, then that's just crazy. Just trying to soak up as much as possible. But the thing is, your adrenaline's pumping. Everything, you know, that it's actually hard to take it all in some ways.
Do you feel shell-shocked, do you think? Like, there's just so much. You've just basically rinsed your body physically, and now you're trying to deal with it mentally, and there's so much noise. Everyone else is excited, and you're probably like that. What the fuck?
Yeah, you know, you're still trying to catch up. Your brain's still trying to catch up with what on earth has just gone on there. And that's why in many ways, when I look back on it, it kind of feels very dreamlike, very vague, because I think your adrenaline is so high and you're in a moment, a very, very kind of, you know, challenging moment, that it's difficult to take in your surroundings in many ways. You haven't got space for that. So then your memory becomes fairly lucid and a bit vague. Did it actually happen to me? Did that actually happen to me? Because I can't really feel it.
Mental. How did life change after the 2012? Like, I was, you know, I'm going to say, how did life change after the Olympics? But really, it's, you know, the 2012 Olympics, because you went out.
Yeah.
That was you, I suppose, would you say retiring?
Yeah.
So how did your life change after that Olympics?
Well, I thought that I'd be very happy to not have to carry that kind of expectation on my shoulders, and that I could settle down, do some gardening, basically live my best lockdown life.
Yeah.
And I soon realised very quickly that I was kind of bored of it.
Yeah.
I think everyone thought, you know what, she's married, she's settled, she's going to have babies and live happily ever after. And I was like, I don't really feel that way, and I can't deny the way I feel. I kind of feel like I want to do more. You know, I still feel like I could be an athlete. And that's kind of, you know, it broke my heart in many ways, because I would have liked to have continued to Rio, but the option wasn't there. I mean, I was lucky to go to Rio and be part of the BBC commentary team, and that was brilliant. But I really wanted to be there. I didn't feel I'm done. I still don't feel I'm done. I've got problems, Foxy. I've got problems. I was like, it's been delayed for a year. Maybe I can make a comeback to Tokyo Olympics. No. But I kind of took up running and doing other sports that I was never allowed to do. But when I took up running, I started to do like 400 meter efforts at the local track.
Yeah.
Bought some spikes. Started going a bit crazy at it. And everyone's like, really, Victoria, just, well, you know, you can just chill out if you want. And I'm trying to make myself spew. I'm trying so hard. I'm like, just come. I kind of want to do it, but I don't want to do it. What? I don't know what to do, because that's the only thing I've ever known. I didn't want to cycle because that hurt. Like, heartbroken. I was just constantly looking for new and different things to do. I mean, I was lucky to do lots of sports, things like surfing, things like skiing, things I haven't been allowed to do for risk of injury. And I was enjoying those.
I think we people at home, as sort of like non-professional athletes or sports persons, we forget that you're not allowed to do stuff. I was watching a TV show the other day, and it was Peter Crouch, and he's allowing himself with other ex-footballers, I think, to go and do stuff they never did. And it was my first realization of, oh yeah, I go skiing in the winter if I can and do stuff. And I'm very grateful for my time in the military, because it allows you to do that sort of thing. But then you forget that there's, because everyone thinks sports people are mega outdoorsy, outgoing, which you all are, but you're not allowed to do it to a certain degree, because what you're trying to achieve is too important to the, you know, the cause, isn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, in your contract, it says to avoid sports, obviously dangerous sports. They can't stop you, but you choose not to because it is your job. And it would look very bad if you went skiing and broke your ankle, and it might not be your fault. So you have to kind of think, well, there'll be plenty of time for that when I retire. So I was making time for it when I retired. Immediately, I did lots of different things, lots of new sports, which I really enjoyed. And, you know, for me, going skiing after the Olympics, that following year, I think I did three ski trips that winter. And because I was still physically strong, I was like, I was getting away with absolute murder. I was like, I should probably be more careful. But I had enough muscle, not style, to get myself out of trouble.
Yeah, that's my style normally.
That was fun. Like, I love that. But I still feel there's a kind of yearning to do something more seriously. Like, I'd love to be an athlete more than anything else in the world. I wish I could still be an athlete.
Well, you are remembered as an athlete. Oh, remember, you haven't lost that. You've carved your name into history, but you have chosen also to do a sport which would be considered quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Riding horses, jockey. Why? I mean, I know that you love horses anyway, don't you?
I've never really ridden a horse before, but I do love animals. I love horses, and I thought when somebody offered me this chance to learn to ride as a jockey, I was like, yeah, I'll give that a go. Never done it before, and I remember thinking, well, unless you try, you don't know. It might be like the best thing I've ever done. So I thought, well, I'll have a couple of lessons. for a few days, and then I'll get back to you and see if you want me to train to become a jockey for the next 12 months, jump jockey as well. So I was like, I spent 10 minutes in my first lesson, absolutely scared shitless on this ginormous horse called the Secret Weapon. I was like, it's a long way to fall from up here. It was nerve-wracking, and I absolutely loved it. I could feel that sense of adrenaline and excitement in it, and I was like, this horse was an eventing champion, a Blenheim champion. So he was like putting a novice, no, maybe somebody just passed their driving test, in a Ferrari. And I was like, oh, it was sensitive, really responsive, powerful, muscly. And I was like, this is like having this amount of power with a brain is terrifying and brilliant in equal quantities. Yeah. I just fell in love with it immediately.
So do you think that's given you, you know, post being an Olympic athlete, yeah, being a world champion, has that given you, is that some of the release that you've needed, is that ability to go out and ride horses and jump?
100%. It's absolute thrill. It's a huge adrenaline rush. It was something that I could focus my training, because I was riding race horses after I'd sort of passed my early development. I'd gone to jockey school with all the kids. I was like mum who kind of turned up. So I'd done all this jockey school thing in Newmarket. I'd proved that I could ride confidently. I was riding for stables, jumping horses. So I was training 6 days a week, and I would be up at 5:30, finished at 12, and then I'd go and have a lesson with Yogi in the afternoon. And for me, it was like being back in my own life. So I was having like a regime, I was training hard, and I was taking it very seriously and focusing on it, because it's a dangerous sport. You know, I could seriously do some damage, if not worse, if I get this wrong. So for me, the focus, having a focus like that, a serious focus, really gave me kind of something to grab onto, and I loved it. And also, someone said I couldn't do it, which equally...
Yeah, I've got that theme, basically. Yeah, if you want, so if anyone wants Victoria Pendleton to do something, tell her she can't do it.
Yeah.
But so you obviously didn't go straight into being, you know, riding horses. So I mean, would you mind? I mean, I'm big into the whole mental health side of things. Would you mind telling us a bit about your journey with mental health post sort of, you know, your professional athletic career, and how did that manifest itself?
So I've always been somebody who's had to work on my mental approach, mainly because I'm not a particularly confident individual, and I take things very personally, and I beat myself up. Like when I make mistakes, I really beat myself up for it, to a point where I'm destructive. And that's something that I've always struggled with my whole life. And I, you know, I've had highs and lows, and being in an elite sports situation with immense pressure and expectation, and the uncertainty of not being able to deliver it, because you never know what's going to happen on race day. And your wage is based on whether you deliver year on year. Your contract is based every year on year on whether you've performed. It wore down, and I struggled with it. And I was lucky enough to work with Dr. Steve Peters, who wrote the Chimp Paradox. He was part of the support system. And I don't know what I would have done without him, because he really helped me kind of identify my own faults in terms of how I approach things.
Yeah.
So work on strategies to be better at what I do. And I can honestly say, if I hadn't have met Steve and worked with him, I wouldn't have achieved what I achieved, which... I know some people might think, well, that's rubbish. But I was like, well, just like you have to have physical coaching, I think having mental coaching is the same. Sometimes.
When did that come about? When did that relationship with Steve start?
Probably in my early 20s.
Oh, right. Okay. So that he's there for pro athletes, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's a great book, by the way.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, some people would be like, oh, embarrassed to say that they need to work on that, because sometimes I used to get very low and very down on myself, and it wasn't helpful to my performance. I know that. And he was able to give me the tools to kind of work it out. And it wasn't necessarily about, like, when people think of sports psychology, it's not like imagery and imagining the race and stuff like that. It's more about what makes me tick as an individual and how best I manage the personalities around me and whatnot. And yeah. how to sort of recognize when I'm going to go on a downer about something and how to rectify it. And that was, you know, they were basic life skills.
And do you still employ them today?
I do. I still do the same. I still have the same faults. You know, I still beat myself up when things don't go right. Mm. And usually it's my unreasonable level of expectation. And people piss me off because they don't adhere to the rules of my kind of my being and my level of expectation. And I'm like, well, it's not for me to make someone else do that. Like, I have to, you know, recognize that. But, you know, like, for me, I thought that I was suffering at times there, and I definitely was down. I wouldn't say maybe mildly depressed during times of my athletic career, but it wasn't until much later in my life and in retirement that I really experienced mental health difficulties to a level that I needed someone to come in and help me out. And I think that's probably partly to do with the loss of identity in many ways.
Yeah. Well, thanks for chatting about that. In fact, actually, what advice would you, the legend that's Victoria Pendleton, give to anyone that sort of feel, if anyone's out there struggling, what sort of advice would you give them?
Mm. So I guess people struggle. It's not unusual. I think the main things I'd probably say is you're never alone. There's always somebody out there who will understand where you're coming from and be able to help and support you. So don't be afraid to speak up about it or ask for help. Because let's face it, if somebody asked me for help and I can give help, I would happily and really enjoy being able to offer help to somebody else, because it would come from a place of compassion, and I get it because I felt it and it's awful. So I think, understand that people are always there for your help and speak up. The second thing would be that there is always light at the end of the tunnel, however dark it seems, and however hard it seems to move on from one place, one repetitive suffering, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Be patient, because it's when someone tells you to be patient when you're suffering, you want to punch them, because the first thing you want to do is get out of it.
Yeah.
Get out of it by whatever means you can possibly use to get out. But unfortunately, it's a process that takes time, and I think you have to be able to be patient. And I think the third thing I'd probably say is find joy. You have to seek joy in your life, because no one else is going to put it on your plate in front of you. You've got to do things that make you happy. And even if that means going outside and looking at a nice tree in your garden to start with, because that's all you can muster up, or going for a little walk somewhere quiet because that's all you can manage, do it, because it has to build on things you love. You have to put in the things that make you happy. And that might be a delicious latte. That might be going on a surf holiday in my personal experience. You know, it might be going for a nice walk, taking the dog out. But little steps of finding joy.
I wholeheartedly agree. And that's great advice. Let's go on to lighter hearted subjects quickly. Tattoos, you're obviously sporting on there. I know you're into them. I know your partner, and he's got some banging tattoos.
Yes.
Any more future plans?
Yes. As soon as lockdown allows us to get tattoos, I'm going to get Athena on my other shoulder, the same size as Medusa, so I can have both sides of good/evil, if we can call Medusa evil. She was cursed. It wasn't her fault. So
yeah.
I'm going to have Athena of that. Wisdom and whatever. And then I'm going to have two tarot cards on my biceps. So I've got four in the making, but I also have some Everence to put in from my dog. So I've got Stella and Jonty. I've got their little names there because that's the hands that I used to walk them on. I've got them tattooed on both wrists, Stella and Mr. Jonty. But I want to get something else for them, just because they're a big part of my life, 10 years of my life, and I bloody love those Dobermans.
Yeah. Everence is great.
Yeah.
Good thing. Mm. So if anyone wants to know about that, look it up. Google Everence.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've touched on, I was going to ask next, pretty much when lockdown ends properly, what are your plans? Obviously, ink.
Ink, loads of ink. I want to get full sleeves.
But what else?
Well, I've actually got, I want to go on some serious motorcycle adventures. That's what I want to do. Because I really love my street scrambler more than life itself, actually. I feel emotionally attached to my motorcycle, my Triumph motorcycle. I love it. I want to go on some camping trips, like take a little tent and go whizzing around somewhere, maybe go around Scotland somewhere, depending on the time of year, or go abroad and just kind of explore some places. Keep it basic, small bag. I'd love to get involved with doing some documentaries of that nature. And I don't think there is necessarily enough female representation in that place.
It doesn't seem to be, does there?
I'm very willing to be, you know, down and dirty with it.
Going hardcore.
I don't mind it. I quite like it. And I'd like to do that.
In the military, we call it hard routine, where you basically sleep on the floor, eat cold food, and generally lead an extremely miserable life.
I'm happy to do
it's not,
that.
It's not, I joke, I'm joking, it's not actually miserable, it's just you're being properly with nature. So that's, that's
hard
pretty
routine,
much,
yeah.
Hard routine, that's pretty much what I'm looking forward to be honest with you. I'm going to ask two of my last questions, and then I've got a load of sort of questions from people, readers, listeners, whatever you want to call them. So I'll ask one of those at the end, which I don't know. I haven't looked at it yet, so I haven't picked it yet. So first of all, before we get there, biggest inspiration for you in your life, who is it?
My mum.
Good answer. Very good answer. Yeah. And can you sum up what your mentality for life is?
Don't let anyone else put judgments on what you can achieve.
Yeah, and I'd like to back you up on that. You're an amazing example of just that, being told you're not good enough for something and then basically becoming an Olympic and world champion multiple times. Right, well, I'm going to move on now to the readers' questions before we finish. I've really enjoyed this. But right, here we go. So this is from Ruthie_P83. On Instagram, and obviously you spoke earlier about the reason I've picked this, because you spoke earlier about lying on the floor, looking up at the ceiling, listening to stuff prior to, you know, literally just before the race, getting ready. So what do you listen to? What's on your playlist? I want to know what was on your playlist for, you know, in your prep periods for pre-race.
Okay, so at that moment I was listening to Linkin Park, Jay-Z, Collision Course, 99 Problems, but a bit chain one, which I think is quite funny, being in sprint racing. But for me, the go-to, generally, if I look at the things I've listened to the most, would be The Prodigy. Like, Fat of the Land is probably one of my favourite albums of all time ever. To a point where I anticipate every note that's coming. I actually have the signed discs in my downstairs toilet from the guys saying they were behind me because they knew I was a fan going into the Olympics. Like, congrats on the gold medal, we're behind you all the way. And they all signed it. So I've got a Keith signature on my wall downstairs.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so Victoria, VP, I've got to wrap it up now. That was awesome. It's a privilege to speak to you. It's been a privilege to actually get to know what it's like to be the achiever that you are and what it takes to get there and the feelings that you've gone through when you've been doing what is essentially an unbelievably amazing career. So thanks, legend. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Foxy.
Thanks very much to Victoria. Hope you enjoyed that. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast, and thanks for listening. Take it easy, and I'll see you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.